Welcome to this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, the chair of the Humanities Forum, and I welcome you all to today's event. I also welcome our radio and our online audiences, and we invite everyone to visit us at www.commonwealthclub.org. It's my pleasure today to introduce the speaker, Professor Timothy Hampton, professor of French literature and comparative literature at the University of California, Berkeley, who will be speaking about Michel de Montaigne, the philosopher of improvisation. Thanks.
Thanks very much, George, and thank you all for coming out tonight to listen to me talk about Montaigne. Montaigne may not be completely familiar to all of you, since I know you're philosophy nuts. Since he's often taken as a kind of light philosopher, a sort of light moral philosopher. You may have read him in college in a great books course or a Western Civ course. So he may not be completely fresh in your minds. But what I want to do tonight is present his work briefly. I have a text here, but I'll try not to read it or use it too much. On the other hand, I have a microphone, so I can't run around the room like I'd like to. But I'd like to offer a way into his book and suggest some ways of reading it that could be useful. And I want to do that by working through some very specific passages that I put on this handout. He's very difficult to paraphrase, so I didn't want to kind of come in and paraphrase his ideas because that would make him seem really not interesting, I think. So what I'll do is try and offer a kind of model of reading, which we'll do together, I hope. We might call this a kind of exercise or some exercises in reading. They're not dangerous, and actually you can do them at home afterwards. And if we have time, I've brought in an entire essay, a very small essay that we could even talk about. We'll see how much time we have. Actually, I should take my watch off and make sure. My hope is that this will make the text come alive in a way that it might not otherwise, and my sincere hope is that this doesn't appear overly heavy or pedantic because of its detailed nature. By the way, there are handouts. George, if you want to... Yeah. Okay. So what's at stake in what I want to try and do is really how we think about reading and how we think about reading a philosopher like Montaigne. And that's a very big and pressing question because it's about our relationship to all kinds of texts, philosophical texts, literary texts, and to the notion of tradition generally. Now, Montaigne has a curious position in the history of philosophy. He's sort of the last pre-modern philosopher, and he's also the first postmodern philosopher in some way. He sort of missed modernity in a way. He's the last of the old philosophical tradition to the extent that he's deeply invested in the classical culture of the Renaissance. He's, after all, from the 16th century, and he comes just before Descartes, right? He's a contemporary of Bacon. So Bacon's emphasis on the observation of nature as the a path to truth is something that Montaigne somehow misses. Similarly, Descartes' rejection of the body in his quest for a firm grounding upon which to base knowledge is something that requires in some way the sweeping aside of Montaigne, since Montaigne is deeply interested in the body and deeply interested in uncertainty, and those are two things that drive Descartes crazy, as we know. The other person that Descartes drives that Montaigne drives crazy is the French philosopher that's closest to him historically, and that's Pascal, who was apoplectic, really, reading Montaigne, because Montaigne was such a happy person, and Pascal was so deeply miserable in every part of his being that he goes on and on in the Pensées about what a problem Montaigne is. So Montaigne's very much in the news right now. There was a thing in the New York Times Book Review about a month ago, I think, which on the last page, which declared this to be the Montaigne moment. And this was partly around the book of Sarah Bakewell, which some of you may know, called How to Live, which is a really smart and accessible way into Montaigne's work, and argues that the book of the essays is really a book about how to live and tries to sort of work through what that means. But there have been a number of other exegeses of Montaigne recently that have brought him really into our historical moment in a very powerful way. The New York Times says that Montaigne is the first blogger, and I'll say a little bit more about that in a minute. But a few years ago, the New Republic had a review of a new translation of the essays in which they declared that Montaigne was the inventor of jazz because he's his writing is based upon a kind of improvisational approach, and I'll talk about that a bit more as we go. But there's a lot of scholarly interest in Montaigne recently. I mean, a couple of years ago, the distinguished historian of philosophy, Stephen Toulmin, wrote a book called Cosmopolis, in which he argued for a sort of new reading of the history of modern philosophy that would begin with Montaigne rather than with Descartes. Montaigne's interest in the body and in the experience of his own body is also something that has been very relevant to recent philosophical writing, and in particular, I think, obliquely at least, to a number of feminist engagements with the philosophical tradition, which argue that the Cartesian tradition at least has forgotten the experience of the body and that we need to return to thinking about what it means to live in the body. So there's a real sense that Montaigne is here, and it's a good time to think about him. So what I want to do is talk a little bit about the close connection between Montaigne's thought and the way he writes. So I'm going to try and sort of talk a little bit about this curious character of the book called The Essays. Right, and he's really a very great writer, and we teach him in literature courses at Cal, as I guess most people do. And he's, in that sense, he's one of those philosophers who is really both a kind of artist as well as a thinker. Along with, we would think of Plato and Nietzsche and Emerson, possibly in that company. So let me begin by giving a tiny bit of background, historical background, to Montaigne's project, as I understand it. This is just to give you a kind of way to sort of place him. So he was born in the 1530s in the southwest of France, near Bordeaux. And he was born during the great flowering of the Renaissance in France. This is the period when the French are engaging in their first, the first moment of a very long process, which continues to this day, of stealing culture from Italy and bringing it to France, right? Napoleon did it probably better than anybody else, but it started with Francis I in the early 16th century, who invaded the Italian peninsula many times trying to get control of it, and what he brought back was not control of the Italian peninsula, but the Renaissance. And so there were all of these French aristocrats who went to Italy and said, my God, we are really out of it, look at these guys, and brought back paintings, languages, statues, and so on and so forth. And Francis I, of course, the French king, was the first great collector of Italian art, and he brought Leonardo da Vinci to work for him, and so on and so forth. So Montaigne is born during this great cultural flowering, which is the moment of, in French literature, the moment of Rabelais, the beginnings of modern secular literature in some way. It's also the moment of the importation of humanism into France, what's often called Christian humanism. We might think of in the English tradition of a writer like Thomas More, who was active during this time, or Erasmus of Rotterdam, who was the kind of great international intellectual superstar writing in the 1520s and 1530s. This is the time at which Montaigne was born, and his father was deeply influenced by this new humanist culture and wanted to give Montaigne a humanist education. So he's deeply schooled in the classics, and in particular in Latin culture. And actually, he tells us in his essay on the education of children that his father was so concerned that he get a classical education that he hired a tutor who spoke no French, but only Latin. This was a German tutor, spoke only Latin. So Montaigne's first language was Latin. And he says, you know, they learned enough Latin to sort of babble to each other in Latin around the household. And It was later then that he was sent to the best school in France, which was in Bordeaux, and studied with some very great humanists, that he says his Latin went downhill and was sort of degenerated into bad Latin. And then he claims that as an adult, his Latin is terrible. But he read deeply in Latin. He didn't know Greek, but he read deeply in the Latin classics. And he was obviously sort of destined by his father to be a kind of dead Roman, in the 16th century. He was supposed to be a kind of Cicero or, you know, Virgil kind of figure, right? So Montaigne goes to school in Bordeaux and prepares for a life of public service. He studies the law, and he enters the judiciary in Toulouse. And there he has an encounter that changes his life. He meets another humanist intellectual who was about his age, whose name was Étienne de la Boétie. And they became very deep friends. And la Boétie was from a place called Sarlat, which is, you know, I don't know. Yes? Not too far from Bordeaux. What? Okay, all right. So it's a movie set mostly, I know, Sarlat these days. But anyway, so not far away. So two Gascons, or two southern French intellectuals. And Montaigne's relationship to La Boétie is often presented in a kind of, you know, it's sort of passed over quickly. But I've been thinking about it recently, and it strikes me that it must have been extraordinary. I mean, this is someone, if we think of Montaigne, this is someone who spends much of his time on an estate where he may well be the only person who can read. And he's certainly the only person who can read Latin, and he's certainly the only person for miles around who has the kind of love that he does of poetry and philosophy and literature. And that must be an extraordinarily solitary feeling to have. And he meets this other guy who's not from very far away, who has a similar education, who lives in the same part of the country, who is about his age, and with whom he has an immense amount in common, and they become very fast friends. Just as things are getting going, La Boétie dies at an early age, having left a few writings behind him. And this is a terrible blow to Montaigne. And he withdraws from public life at that point, or so he says. I mean, that's not quite true. But he basically installs himself in his father's chateau among his books. And he says that his idea is to spend what's left of his life in reflection and preparation for death. So this is at the ripe old age of 38. He's getting ready to tell it goodbye. And he says in his essay, the essay called Of Idleness, which is a really wonderful essay, he says that he was unable to get control of his thoughts in the way that he had thought he would be able to. Anyone who's ever tried to meditate knows what that feels like. And so he begins writing things down. And he doesn't know what he's writing, but he's just sort of writing something. And the result of this writing exercise was this volume that's called The Essays, that's published first in 1580. Now, the word essay was invented by Montaigne. It comes from the Latin word exagium, which means balance, like a scale, right? And the idea, and this was Montaigne's emblem. He had actually had a medal with a scale cast, which he carried around, I guess. And the idea is that to essay something, and the French word essayer, as we know, means to try out, right? To assay, as we would say in Northern California after the Gold Rush, is to weigh something. And an essay, therefore, is a weighing and a testing of one idea against another, or one solution against another, or one form of action against another, and a testing of your own knowledge against against what is already known. Some of the essays are on very traditional topics, like moderation and virtue and things like that. There's one on solitude, one on sadness. But a lot of them are on topics that people had never really written about in any kind of extensive way. The essay on cannibals leaps immediately to mind, of course. That was the hot topic in the 1570s. But we could also think about one of my favorites, which is an essay called Of Thumbs, which is about different sized thumbs and the value or inconvenience of thumbs, right, so on and so forth. Or one of his most famous essays, which is the one called Of Experience, which is the last essay. Now, let me just say a couple of things very quickly about the historical context of the project of writing the essays, right? In the 1570s and 80s and 60s and 70s, when Montaigne is writing, France is going through an extraordinary period of chaos and upheaval. This is the time of religious wars between the Protestants and the Catholics, which were truly horrendous, and where France saw a kind of complete collapse of civic order, and the authority of the monarchy placed in question in a way that it had really never quite been before. And this is a period which actually in the kind of official history of France was often swept under the carpet in the 19th and 20th centuries because it was so horrendous. And when you're trying to sort of promote an idea of French identity, the last thing you want to do is talk about the 35 years of the civil wars in the later part of the 16th century. But this is the time during which Montaigne writes, and he's a Catholic living in a Protestant area and is really a kind of witness to the collapse of his country. And that's quite extraordinary fact which needs to be kept in mind. So what are these things that he writes? The essays are built out of little chunks of material, examples from classical literature, examples from recent history, quotes from other texts, which he just sticks into the middle of his text, usually in Latin. So if you come to the essays as a reader of French without a translation, you get a text which is in French and which has little bits of Latin stuck in it. So it's already a kind of bilingual text, right? And out of this sort of mishmash of junk that he kind of finds from his reading, he weaves his own reflections about what is going on. He talks about his body, his kidney stones, his sort of eccentric personality, his tastes, what he cares about, what he doesn't care about, right? And the magic of the essays, it seems to me, comes in large measure through the kind of dialogue between the things that he says about himself and the kind of received knowledge that he's gotten from tradition. And the picture of himself that he puts forth, and this is in some ways where he's extraordinarily modern, is a picture of someone who is not extraordinary. Montaigne's extraordinariness lies in some sense in his discovery of the fact that he's not extraordinary. And he lives in a culture, let's remember, where figures like Julius Caesar and Socrates and Alexander the Great were constantly being written about, and from classical antiquity, of course, were constantly being written about and rehashed, and contemporary political figures were comparing themselves to these people and so on and so forth. And Montaigne came along and said, you know, not particularly virtuous. I'm not particularly brave. I've got a bad memory. I'm not particularly learned. But I'll tell you about myself. And perhaps you can get something from that. So in his ordinariness, he becomes a kind of exemplary model of self-exposure and honesty for us as readers. And so it's that sense of a kind of ordinariness, which is, I think, easy for us to relate to today. So that's one thing about him which is extraordinarily modern. Another thing is his strong sense of the limits of what he knows. Again, he's working in a culture where there's been a massive rediscovery of classical antiquity in the preceding 50 years, in which texts are being re-edited, and there are scholars all over the place with long lists of things that they've read and so on and so forth. And Montaigne says, well, I don't really know too much about anything. I read a lot, but I don't know very much about anything. And in any case, my judgment is very weak most of the time. So he has a real sense of the kind of limits of his knowledge. And part of what the essays are about is exploring the limits of his knowledge. Right? So I think that's, again, something which we can relate to and which makes him extremely sort of simpatico to modern readers like us. The kind of schoolboy version of Montaigne that you get, or at least, certainly if you study Montaigne in France, that's what you get, is that he had one great question, and the question was, what do I know? And this is the essay that the question that he asks in his essay on religion, the longest essay, which is called The Apology of Raymond Sebon. The famous question, que sais-je, what do I know? People often say this is kind of the main thing that he was interested in. I don't really think that's true. It seems to me more that he is interested in testing what he knows and what he doesn't know, and the weakness of his knowledge and the strength of his knowledge, which is not quite the same question as what do I know, which seems to suggest some sort of body of knowledge. Anyway, Sarah Bakewell in her book says that the real question is how to live, and I think that's closer to the Montaigne that I know. Now, what I want to talk about, so that's a little bit of introduction. What I want to talk about in more specificity is the kind of fabric of this strange book that Montaigne writes that is completely unique, it seems to me, and certainly was unique in his time. No one had ever written anything like this before. People had written autobiographies, but the essays are not an autobiography. There's nothing narrative or linear. He's not telling the story of his life. People had written philosophical treatises about systematic explorations of a particular topic, but it's not that either. People had published their letters, which included meditations on particular topics, but it's not that either. And in fact, he says at one point that if La Boétie had not died, Montaigne would have published a collection of letters, but since La Boétie died, there's no one to write to. And so he writes essays instead. And so the essays are a kind of substitution for correspondence. It's actually very moving when you think about that. Anyway, what I want to say about the text itself is this, which is that Montaigne published, as I said, a first version of this text in 1580, after which he went to Italy on vacation and to soak in the baths because he suffered terribly from kidney stones and he wanted to see if he could soak his way out of them, which he wasn't able to do. But anyway, he published a first version of this essay and of the essays, and the essays consisted of two books of essays. There was an introduction and a series of essays, and that was sort of it. No sooner, however, had the book appeared than Montaigne went back to the project of the essays, and he began to expand it. And this is what I think is the amazing thing about this book. He wrote a new book of essays. In other words, he wrote more essays, which constitutes the third book. So if you buy the essays today, you get three books of essays. And these are longer essays. Many of them have to do with political topics because he was very concerned about the collapse of France. This was after the St. Bartholomew's Massacre, and things had really heated up. Well, anyway, he adds a third book, but then he does something else, which is really amazing, which is he goes into the text that he had already written, and he writes commentary and more text around it and about it, right? In other words, he goes back to the essays that he's written and he adds more text. He doesn't add it on to the end of the text. He adds it into the middle of the text. In other words, he just goes right into his text and scribbles on it, a kind of marginalia. And I've in the handout, you have actually a facsimile. This is not the real text, so you can write on it. Don't worry. And here's a version. This is a color version. I didn't print it out in color because I didn't want the Commonwealth Club to go broke. But this is actually this is the original. This is a facsimile of the original, which you can find online. A colleague of mine at the University of Chicago has a website called the Montaigne Project, and you can go there and you can see this text. And this is what the last version that he left looks like, and you can see that he's just, and this is the essay on idleness, and you can see that he just scribbles in the margin of his own book, right? And then in 1588, 8 years after the first edition, he publishes a second edition of the essays with all of this stuff stuck into the middle of it, right? So it's now a bigger book. It's not only a third book, but it's each of the essays that he had already written are now redone completely with they're twice as long or they're expanded in various kinds of ways. So that if you bought the book in 1580, you're in trouble because you have to buy it again in 1588. because the essays are all now completely different. And actually, scholars have speculated that maybe one of the reasons that he did this was because, according to the printing laws at the time, you only had control over your own work for 8 years, and you had to you couldn't, after 8 years, somebody else could reprint it. So he wanted to keep control of the printing rights, so he redid it. I mean, that may be one version. But publishes a second edition in 1588, much expanded, and then he goes on, and by this time he's quite famous, and he continues scribbling onto his own book that he's already written and adding more stuff. So it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And when he finally dies in 1594, there is an edition which they found on his bedside, which had, you know, ever more scribbles. In fact, that's what this facsimile is from. It's from the last edition, which is called the Exemplar of Bordeaux, because it's in the Bordeaux Public Library. As I say, you can find it online, so you don't have to go to Bordeaux if you don't want to. this, as you can see already, is a very strange way of writing. And it has a number of implications. First of all, this means that the book of the essays changes as Montaigne changes. In other words, it's coextensive with his life. It's not coextensive with his life in the way that an autobiography would be or a memoir. He's not adding events. He's just adding ideas. And so the book sort of grows like an amoeba and gets bigger and bigger and bigger the more he writes and the more he lives. Right? And as long as he lives, the book will continue to have more material stuck into it. And only when he dies will the book reach its end. So that's very strange, it seems to me. It's unlike any other book that we might know. And this is partly what I think Montaigne's getting at when he says in his very... In the introduction, there's an introduction to the reader where he says, "I myself am the matter of my book," right? And I think that's partly what it's about, because the book is him and he is the book. And he gives a pretty compelling description of how this book works in the first passage that I put on your handout here, which is from an essay called A Practice, which starts out being about how to die, how to practice dying, and ends up being about how to write. And he says there, passage one, he says, "My trade and my art is living. What I chiefly portray is my cogitations, a shapeless subject that does not lend itself to expression and actions. I expose myself entire. My portrait, that's to say my book, is a cadaver on which the veins, the muscles, and the tendons appear at a glance, each part in its place. One part of what I am was produced by a cough, another by a pallor or a palpitation of the heart, in any case dubiously. It is not my deeds that I write down. It is myself. It is my essence." So this is kind of an amazing description of the project of writing. He's trying to capture something in language that is not action. It's not external. It's not an event. It's some kind of movement of what is going on in his head. And this idea that he and himself, he and the book are somehow exactly the same thing, is a very powerful image that's used again and again and again in the essays. There's this sense that it's changing, where, as he says, part of what I am is produced by a cough, another by something. So the essays in some ways are organized according to his body or his kidney stones or his cough or his cold or his ugly face or whatever it is he wants to talk about. So it's a text which is organized unlike anything else we might think of. So there's this kind of sense that the book is constantly changing as he's rewriting it, right? So one of the things that this means is that when we read the essays, we need to take into account how he rewrites himself. In other words, we need to read the essays not only from left to right, from the first paragraph to the last paragraph, to see how they unfold. That's, in some ways, the hardest way to read Montaigne, because he's completely unsystematic, and he just changes directions whenever he wants to. We also need to take a look at how he sticks new bits into the text as he goes and revises it. And we can do this thanks to the miracle of modern scholarly editions, which indicate the different versions of the text that he was writing. And I think this is exactly the way to try and read Montaigne, because he clearly wanted people to compare different versions of the text, which is why he published different editions in his lifetime. And so in a modern scholarly edition, and I saw someone who had the Donald Frame translation, Stanford University Press, which I think is really the best translation, and it's about 40 years old now, but it's really great. And in most modern editions, there are little letters in front of different parts of the text according to whether it's the first edition, the second edition, or the third edition, an A and a B, an A or a B or a C. And so we can sort of see how at a certain moment he goes back and rereads his book and adds something new. And I can give you an example of that, which is the second passage that I put on your handout here. This is the very beginning of the essays. The first essay, which is called "By Diverse Means We Arrive at the Same End," and this essay begins with Montaigne thinking about what, and this is really very relevant to his political situation. He begins by saying, "What should you do if somebody has got you captive and they're about to kill you? What do we do?" So there are two things you could do, he says. You can beg for mercy. Sometimes that works, sometimes it doesn't. Or you can be really tough and take the kind of stoic position and just say, okay, you know, go ahead and kill me. And he gives examples of both sides working. Some people have begged for mercy and it worked. Some people have been very tough, and the person who is about to run him through with the sword says, hey, you're tough, I like you. I won't kill you after all. So it's either solution works, says Montaigne, and he tries to balance the two against each other as a way of sort of survival in the world. And you can see in the second little passage that I quoted for you. So he says, this is the beginning of the very beginning of the essays. He says, the commonest way of softening the hearts of those we have offended is by submission, to move them to commiseration and pity. So that's the pity approach. However, whenever there's a however, you have to be careful in Montaigne. However, audacity and steadfastness have sometimes served to produce the same effect. So he balances two things against each other. And then he gives a couple of examples of people who have been steadfast and have not been killed. So, right? But then, and this is the kind of point that I want to make, is that then when he goes back and rereads his text, he sticks a little sentence in the middle, and that's the thing that's got to be in front of it. He says, either one of these two ways would easily win me, for I am wonderfully lax in the direction of mercy and gentleness. Right? So he's gone back and reread his own book, and he adds this interesting little tidbit, which is also the first moment where he himself talks about himself in the essay. So he appears on page one as a kind of gloss that he's sort of written into reading his own text. He appears as the guy who can't decide one way or the other. So we can sort of track how he's thinking by first looking at the text, and then reading kind of archaeologically, the way you would read if you were excavating a building. We have a first version of reflection, a first level of reflection, and then sort of stick something else in. Let me give you another example of that. And this is actually one of my favorites, which is the third little passage I put. This is from an essay called "Of Liars." It's the ninth essay, so it's pretty early on in the first book of the essays. This is the essay where he talks about memory. And he begins, and it's a very short essay in which he says, in the first version of the essay, he says, I have a terrible memory. Therefore, he says, I have a terrible memory, and people who have a terrible memory shouldn't lie. And therefore, you know, I stay away from lying. Okay. So that's all he says. And he talks about a recent political event where a diplomat was caught lying to the French king and was hoisted by his own petard, so to speak. And so he says, you know, that's it. So, and it's a very little tiny essay, just like a page and a half. Then when he goes back and rereads his own book, he starts sticking material in. So let me just read to you what I've got here under number three. He says, there's no man who's less business talking about memory than me. For I recognize almost no trace of it in me, and I do not think there's another one in the world so monstrously deficient. All my other faculties are low and common, but in this one I think I am singular and very rare, and thereby worthy of gaining a name and reputation. Okay. Then he goes back and rereads this 8 years after he wrote it, and he sticks in a little sentence. He says, besides the natural inconvenience that I suffer by this, if in my part of the country they want to say that a man has no sense, they say he has no memory. And when I complain of the defectiveness of mine, they argue with me and do not believe me, as if I were accusing myself of witlessness. They see no distinction between memory and understanding. This makes me look a lot worse than I am. But they do me wrong, for rather the opposite is seen by experience, that excellent memories are prone to be joined to feeble judgment. So we can see that when he goes back and rereads his own book, first of all, he adds a whole lot more about himself. There's a kind of tone of feeling slightly offended by his neighbors, right? And he also gets to a point where he really overturns the kind of commonplace of his period. He says, everybody says that, you know, a bad memory means a bad understanding. But in fact, he says, and he comes to a very sort of non-conformist position at the end, excellent memories are prone to be joined to feeble judgment. So he overturns the conventional wisdom through this process of going back and reading his own book, right? So it's kind of an amazing way you can sort of watch the philosopher working by rewriting himself. And then at the end, then there's a little bit that I skipped. At the end of his life, he adds just a reference to Plato there in the middle of that passage. He says, for certainly in view of its necessity, Plato is right to call memory a great and powerful goddess. This is one of these little additions. You don't really know what to make of it. But it's also, by tracking the way he rewrites himself, we can also see what he was reading. And in the last version of the text, right at the end of his life, the one that has a C in front of it, most of the references to Plato appear there. So we can sort of track and see that he was reading, at the end of his life, he was reading Plato very deeply, and he's constantly alluding to Plato in these last texts. So anyway, my point then is, as you can see, that through his process of commenting on himself and commenting on what he's already written, he changes his position and in some way comes to kind of quite surprising and quite wonderful insights. Now, this strikes me as a very strange way of writing. It's very digital. I mean, it does look like a blog in a certain kind of way, right? Where you sort of go back and add more stuff. And I can say, I mean, this just as an aside, I taught a seminar last spring at Cal for freshmen on Montaigne, and we read a lot of Montaigne's essays. And we developed a project as we went through the semester in which we used a website and we invented our own Montaigne essay as the semester unfolded. The title of it was called Of Deadlines. And we set up a wiki, which is where everybody can contribute. And so every member of the class would put in a few sentences or a quotation from a popular song or some reference to something they'd been reading, and then someone else would add something. And so people were sort of piling on, and we ended up with this kind of massive, well, not 6 or 7 pages, not massive, but not bad for freshmen, 6 or 7 page Montaigne-like essay called Of Deadlines, as a collaborative enterprise. So this is the kind of writing which almost seems to have invented the internet, you know, 500 years early, right? I'm hoping myself to put together a kind of Montaigne blog and to sort of blog my way through the essays. This will take a long time, and the reason I think I haven't gotten started is because it's a sort of daunting proposition. But the point is that it's a kind of writing which, as I say, seems to kind of almost be digital in its fabric, in the sense that you can always go back and add more. You can always go back and paste. And the important thing to remember is that Montaigne never cut, or almost never cut. He would occasionally get rid of a little bit of a sentence in order to make it follow, but he very rarely cut, and he always pasted. So the text just grew and grew and grew. Let me jump here a bit and just say a couple of more general things and back up a little bit, and then I'll walk us through the other little bits of text that I gave you. When do you need me to stop talking?
You can start Q&A anytime you want.
Okay, so I'll move very quickly because it's much more fun to have Q&A than it is to hear me talk. A couple of things about Montaigne that we could think about generally that he's famous for today. He has extraordinarily modern ideas about a number of moral issues. Which are just worth mentioning in passing. One has to do precisely with the question of New World cannibalism. His essay on cannibals is a very beautiful account of the cannibalistic rituals among the Tupinamba in South America that had just been written about recently by French ethnographers. And Montaigne was really the first person to propose accepting the culture of the cannibals on their terms, rather than seeing them through a sort of European lens. And he has these kind of wonderful phrases where he says, they may seem like barbarous, but they're compared to us, they're not particularly barbarous. And you know, on their own terms, they have a kind of beauty in their culture. And that sense of a kind of cultural relativism, which seems very modern to us, was striking in the 16th century. The other thing that seems particularly modern, to me at least, in terms of his moral positioning, has to do with his relationship to cruelty. He has a beautiful essay on cruelty, which I've given you a passage from. And maybe we don't actually have time to walk through that. But it's a very beautiful essay to the extent that it begins by talking about how we can control our worst impulses. And he gets to thinking about controlling our worst impulses, but he starts out by talking about sex. And he says, well, the great example people always talk about is sexual passion. When you're in the midst of sexual passion, you can't control yourself. Everybody knows that. But he says, a more interesting example is the hunt. And when you're just about to murder an animal, he says, you know, you have this kind of bloodlust which comes over in you and you can't stop. And then he does something which is really beautiful, which is he takes the position of the animal, and he considers the theme of cruelty from the position of the animal. And he says, you know, we really owe something to animals, and we owe something to trees and rocks. In fact, we have a kind of bond to nature that suggests that we should not be killing animals and we should not be cruel to them. It's a very, as I say, very strikingly kind of modern ethical position. Let me just say, so that I gave you a passage from that. My point here is that by looking at how Montaigne returns to his own text and comments on it, how he kind of blogs on it, as it were, we can see how new levels of meaning and new nuances accrue as he goes. And the last example I gave you on your handout is from the very end of the essays. This is the essay called "Of Experience," which is really beautiful. And if you don't ever read any other Montaigne, please read that. And here's what he's talking about: old age, and he's talking about the importance of knowing how to live well. And he says, and this is passage 6, he says, "It's an absolute perfection and virtually divine to know how to enjoy our being rightfully. We seek other conditions because we do not understand the use of our own and go outside of ourselves because we do not like what it is like inside." So there he's basically coming out against, I think, against religious fanaticism, partly. But anyway, he's celebrating life. And then he adds this beautiful little passage that has a sea in front of it. "Yet there is no use our mounting on stilts, for on stilts we must still walk with our own legs. And on the loftiest throne in the world, we are still sitting only on our own rump." Right? Then we go back to the B text, where this is 1588, so he only wrote two versions of this one. He says, "The most beautiful lives, to my mind, are those that conform to the common human pattern." You can see that he's really fiddling with the text and adding things. He can't quite get the last lines right? The common human pattern, with order, but without miracle and without eccentricity. "Now old age needs to be treated a little more tenderly. Let us commend it to that god," that is Apollo, "who is the protector of health and wisdom, but gay and sociable wisdom." And then he ends with a quotation from one of Horace's odes: "Grant me, O Latona's son, to be content with what I have, and sound of body and mind, to pass an old age lacking neither honor nor the lyre." And that's where the book ends. But there's this beautiful little reference about sitting on your ass when you're in the highest throne in the world, which he adds in right at the end of his life, which is this kind of beautiful ending point to the essays, and which, as I say, we can see how he's doing that by looking at the kind of different levels of the text. And with that, maybe I should end, and we should have Q&A. Thanks very much for listening.
Thanks, Timothy Hampton, for that great insight into French philosopher Montaigne. I'd like to remind everybody that we're listening to Timothy Hampton speaking on Montaigne, the philosopher of improvisation at the Commonwealth Club of California. And we're ready for questions. Who would like to ask the first one?
Yes, was he influenced by St. Augustine?
Not very much. He quotes him, I think, a couple of times in the essays. Only a couple of times. I mean, one would think that he should obviously be influenced by him, since St. Augustine was the kind of great model for writing about the self, right? That he would have inherited. But he really only mentions him a couple of times, and it's very hard to trace an influence of Augustine's thought in the essays. So it's quite mysterious. And you know, one of the things that's also interesting about Montaigne is that he's for being a good Catholic boy and a good royalist, which he was, he rarely quotes the Bible. He doesn't seem to have spent a lot of time reading the Church Fathers. It's really pagan philosophy that interests him: Stoics, Epicureans, so Seneca, Cicero, Plutarch, these guys. Not St. Augustine. Mysterious, because that would be the obvious place to go.
Rebollier, too, was aware of an enormous multiplicity of perspectives, and there's a lot of cultural relativism in him, too. He was also very well known for a very earthy writing style. Was Montaigne, did he read Rabelais?
Rabelais? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
How much? What was the extent of the influence?
That's a great question. He quotes him, I think, twice. He makes a reference to his funny tales, as he puts it. And then he quotes, there's a wonderful moment in Rabelais, in the preface to one of his works. So Rabelais, this is a kind of this great, very earthic French writer of tales about giants who was active in starting in the 1530s. So he's kind of the generation before Montaigne. And there's this moment in one of Rabelais' prefaces where he talks about standing up for his book and its content. Rabelais was always in trouble with the censors. He was constantly on the index or on the Sorbonne's censorship list. And Rabelais says at one point, he says, "I'll stand behind my book right up to the stake. I won't go to the stake, but right up to the stake." Right? He says in French, "Jusqu'au feu exclusif." That's to say, right up to the text, but up to the stake. But there, you know, I don't care about it that much. Right? And Montaigne quotes that phrase, which must have been, you have become proverbial from Rabelais, "Jusqu'au feu exclusif," where he talks about his own about people who are overly opinionated. And Montaigne says, "I like to stick to my opinions, jusqu'au feu exclusif." In other words, I'll hold my opinions too, but I'm not going to go. And you know, in Montaigne's case, he's living in a time where people are being burned all around him because they are willing to go to the stake. And Montaigne's moderate, and he says, "No, I'm not going to do that." So I think those are the explicit references to Rabelais. But I think he must have read him a lot, you know. And he has a whole, it's a beautiful essay called "On Some Verses of Virgil," which is all about sex. You wouldn't think it's the verses from Virgil he's talking about are Virgil's description of Venus and Mars making love. Anyway, he has this whole long thing about sex and about how we have to be able to talk about the body, we have to be able to talk about our bodily functions and blah, 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 blah. And it seems very Rabelaisian. So I think he must have read him a lot and thought about him a lot.
I was just wondering if you could elaborate on what made Montaigne happy, because I'm not sure if that came across with his kidney stones and his other kind of impairments. But I'd love to learn more about that in particular.
Yeah, that's a great question. What makes him happy? I think happiness may not necessarily even be the right word to use to think about him. I think contentment might be a better word, right? Where he says, you know, let us, in that last passage I read, he says, it's an absolute perfection and virtually divine to know how to enjoy our being rightfully. And by that he means, he gives really what's really a fairly conservative version of life, which is to say, know who you are, know what your station in life is. In my case, You know, I happen to be an aristocrat, so that's good. But there is a little aristocratic ideology going on here. But he says, you know, and I'm comfortable with who I am, and I accept that. And I accept that, you know, I have these horrible kidney stones and I'm in pain all the time, but I can learn from that. And I learn, you know, what's valuable and what isn't valuable. And I learn that death is actually not going to be that bad compared to what I've been through. So I'm learning all the time from my experience. And that gives me a certain kind of contentment. So he's not about, you know, he's not into happiness. He's into a certain kind of contentment and even a kind of, I would call it a kind of cheerfulness. With in accepting his life. And again, that's the thing that that drove Pascal bonkers, that he was so content with who he was. Whereas for Pascal, we're not supposed to be content, right? Just be miserable.
I'd like to know a little about the chronology, actually, if I got this right. He lost his friend when he was around 38.
Yes.
Then he wrote the first edition and he published that in 80.
Yes, yes.
And then he died in 94. So
yes.
Now, was he around 52 or 55 or was he in mid-50s?
He was born in 1533. Thank you. He was born in 1533, so he would have been 61.
61, okay. Right. So did he die of these kidney stones?
I think he died of what they call in the 16th century apoplexy, which I think is like a kind of a stroke.
Right.
Was he very sure about himself? Because I once read, he said, I care not so much what others think about me, but I care about what I think about myself.
Yes, and that's a great quote. And what was the question?
Yeah, if he was very sure about himself, according to this essay, I would think.
What he says in I think that's true, and he says negative version of Montaigne, if would be something like the Machiavellian dissimulate courtier politico who's dishonest, who manipulates some people. And Montaigne makes a big deal of the fact that he doesn't want to have anything to do with life at court. He's been to court. He didn't like it. He came home. And he's always presenting himself as the guy who cannot dissimulate and tell lies and flatter. He won't do any of those things. And there's a wonderful moment where toward the end of his life, he was elected the mayor of Bordeaux, which is actually not, I mean, they don't have a campaign or anything, but he was chosen by the city fathers in Bordeaux to be the mayor, which his father had been before him. And he served two terms as mayor of Bordeaux. And he says in one of his essays, the essay on controlling the will, he says, before I took up the job, I told him, this is what you can expect from me, and this is what you can't expect from me. I'll do these things, but I'm not going to do those things. And then we had it all out on the table. They knew what to expect from me, and they knew what not to expect from me. So I could just go ahead and be myself. And they weren't going to be angry with me because I hadn't told them that I was going to do anything that I wasn't going to do. So that seems to go along with what you're saying, that he had this kind of sense of happiness, happiness is the wrong word, I just said, contentment in himself and an acceptance of who he was, which is, I think, really beautiful and very rare for his period in some way.
I think a very aristocratic tendency to tell them, you know, I'll do this, yes, but only on my terms.
Yes, yes.
I read that he had a big influence on Emerson, and I'm wondering if you can talk about that a little bit and also what of that might have trickled down into modern American thought.
Yeah, boy, that's a tricky one. He did have an influence on Emerson, and I really – this is something I want to work on study myself. I've had this kind of idea for years of working really intensively on Emerson, and I never seem to be able to get around to it. But Emerson loved Montaigne, and he wrote in his collection of essays called Representative Men, there's an essay called Montaigne or the Skeptic. This is also where Emerson has his beautiful essay about Shakespeare called Shakespeare the Poet, and he has a whole series of essays. And he talks precisely about Montaigne's acceptance of the world and his curiosity and his sense of his own limitations. And I think those are the things that Emerson cared about very much. How we go from there to kind of more Emersonian themes, I'm not quite sure. I'm gonna lay it out here. This is the limits of my own competence. But it's something I really wanted to think about, just mainly because Emerson is so wonderful to read. But I think there is a real dialogue between. I mean, they're very much sort of kindred spirits across the centuries.
Was Montaigne more influenced by Plato or Aristotle?
Both and neither. I think he read them both. You can't really say he's a Platonist, you know, or an Aristotelian the way you can with other philosophers of his period. The people that he's most influenced by are people that nobody reads today, like Plutarch, for example, right? We all know of Plutarch because he wrote the famous Lives of the Greeks and Romans, right, which Shakespeare read, and he did read the Lives of the Greeks and Romans. But what a lot of people don't know is that Plutarch wrote a lot of other stuff that nobody reads anymore. He wrote this giant collection of essays called the Moralia, which were translated into French by a friend of Montaigne, so Montaigne read them, which have kooky little titles. They're little essays. They have kooky little titles like how to teach boys to read poetry, whether it's better to eat vegetables or meat. I mean, all kinds of strange little topics. And Plutarch was a Reader's Digest guy. He sort of grabbed all the stuff that was kind of floating around, because he's a very late writer. He's like first century AD, writing in Greek. And he kind of grabbed all of the sort of garbage that was floating around left over from classical culture, and he sort of put it into his book. And he was somebody that Montaigne was very influenced by. He was also very influenced by Seneca as well. Again, both Seneca and Plutarch are people that aren't really read very much. Seneca maybe more than Plutarch, but if you go to the classics department at Cal, I mean, and you ask them about Plutarch, they look at you like you're... It's like, who cares? Neither Platonist nor Aristotelian, except, as I suggested, we have a sense that at the end of his life, in the last version of the essays, he does make a number of allusions to Plato. So we have the sense that he was reading Plato at the end of his life.
All right, we have time for one more question.
How about the influence of Lucretius?
Lucretius, he does seem to have been influenced by. There was a kind of... as I understand it, there was a kind of boom in Lucretius about the time in the late part of the 16th century, and the Lucretius's poem on the nature of things was sort of rediscovered and circulated. And there are a number of quotations of Lucretius, in particular, interestingly enough, in the essays where he talks about the New World. Because Lucretius is so interested in the origin of matter and how atoms bang into each other and so on and so forth. And Montaigne is interested in how continents discover each other and how one world discovers another world. And when he talks about that, he often quotes Lucretius. So that's kind of an interesting...
I've also seen a scholarly study of Montaigne's own copy of the Nature of Things and his annotation.
Great. Beautiful. Okay, so he was an annotator of he annotated everything. The other thing I could say just that we should also remember is that Shakespeare read Montaigne. I mean, that's another nice thing is that we know that Montaigne was translated very quickly into English by a guy named John Florio, and Shakespeare read him. And in The Tempest, Shakespeare's last play, when Gonzalo, who is the wise counselor on the island, speaks of founding a new perfect commonwealth where there will be no slavery and no oppression and no this, and he talks about the golden age, blah, blah, blah. He's literally quoting Montaigne's essay on the cannibals. So there's a nice connection there between Montaigne and Shakespeare.
And there's an even more interesting connection with this Lucretius, which is on October 10th, we have Harvard professor Stephen Greenblatt coming here, who's the author of The Swerve, about how modern man became modern, and the story of how a text of Lucretius's was found in the library and changed things quite a bit. So
Stephen
that's,
Greenblatt.
That's in October on Monday Night Philosophy. Great. And thank you very much, Professor.
Thank you. Thank you.
Great lecture. Well, we thank our audience here as well as our listening and online audience, and that concludes yet another meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California in its 108th year of enlightened discussion.